So yesterday we read from Savitri those magical lines. Of course, every line is magical. All our earth starts from the mud and ends in the sky. And Sri Aurobindo describes the evolution of love from the animal level, where love is only about devouring and desiring, to a sweet madness in the rapturous heart, love which assumes a little more human dimension, where it becomes a feeling of mutuality, of love, of togetherness, to love which becomes a ardent comradeship in the happy mind. So love where there is a sharing of thoughts, mutuality of ideas. But that is not the end of the journey of love. It is perhaps the human peak. Love can go further. And the next step of love is where the lonely soul passions for the alone. So after love has gone through the human experience, has experienced the physical, vital and mental sheaths, or the physical, vital and mental forms of love, the power of love is not satisfied. It is described as the most dissatisfied Godhead. Sri Aurobindo speaks in Savitri of the burning test of the Godhead in our parts. There the dissatisfied Godhead here could dwell. Because of all the Godheads, love is the most demanding. That is why the Godhead of love, Sri Krishna, is supposed to be the most demanding. Though he is so sweet, so charming, so pleasing, he draws us very readily, but flees from our embrace. And every time we think we have caught him, he is again, no. So the entire Gita in the process. So love is the most dissatisfied Godhead. So a time comes in our journey when we turn away from human love to love that is divine, to love for the divine. The mother says that there is only one love, and it is the divine love. But in human beings, it turns into love for the divine. That's where we can get a little touch of that. But even that is not the final consummation of love, since we are here to express and manifest that divinity. Within us, we should be able to embody and manifest the divine love in earthly form. And that's what we read yesterday, where the condition to manifest that, it must change its human ways to ways divine, yet it should not lose anything of the earthly bliss. This is a great challenge, that love must definitely, by turning to the divine, it must get irradiated, influenced, penetrated, transfigured into divine love. And yet this love would be a great power for earth if it can express itself in human forms, in everyday life, in our relation with the world. If we look at it superficially, it looks as if it is love that is changing its nature. But if we go to the depths, we discover it's not love that is changing its nature, because there is only one love. There is no two love. But it is the consciousness that is changing under the pressure of love. And as is the consciousness, so is the capacity of the one love to express itself. The mother says at one place very interestingly, "My child, it is very simple. If you have the consciousness of an animal, you love like an animal. You have the consciousness of a human being, you love like a human being. And if you have the consciousness of a God, you love like a God." So we will read a little bit of what it means to love like a God. What is that change? And yet keep its earthly touch. We read number of stories, or heard number of beautiful stories about Yajnavalk. And there is one story which, of course, is well known. I think we touched upon it, or maybe not. Sri Aurobindo, in the synthesis, I'll just read a couple of passages on love that Sri Aurobindo speaks of in the synthesis. So this is a story where Maitri asks him, Yajnavalk, that tell me, why does one, after all, love one's wife? Why does one love one's husband? Why does one love one's child and country and all this? So Yajnavalk gives a very interesting answer, and Sri Aurobindo has his own interpretation of it. "Not for the sake of the wife," says Yajnavalk in the Upanishad, "but for the sake of the self is the wife dear to us. This, in the lower sense of the individual self is the hard fact behind the colored and passionate professions of egoistic love. So he's stripping us bare that people say I love, but they are basically loving with themselves. Yesterday we were talking about it, that even when we turn to God, we are still in love with ourselves, and it's our own shadow that we project on the divine. We, to put it semi-humorously, the divine is busy taking millenniums and millenniums, trilleniums to change us from human to divine. But we in a moment change the divine into human because it suits our purposes. So we have erected a divine who punishes us, a divine who rewards us, a divine who can be pleased if we give him rasgullas. A divine who loves a particular language, a particular form of prayer, a divine who is partial towards a certain community, a divine who is exclusive, and so on and so forth. All these are human conceptions of the divine. And divine allows them, yesterday we read that divine allows these human conceptions because in our ignorance that is how we have to start. And yet a time comes when we have to go past and beyond all these conceptions and discover the utter reality, utter truth of that about which the Upanishad says. We have that passage in the Upanishad when Nachiketa asks Yama, tell me about him, tell me about him. You know, we read something very interesting. It is said that the gods do not know about the secret of immortality. And why they do not know? Because they don't have a psychic being. You know, it's very interesting. So they do not know. It is only through this. This is a capacity given to man through which he can go greater than the gods. So when Nachiketa asks Yama, tell me about that being, effulgent being. So Nachiketa is told by Yama, what? You want to know about him? Na tatra suryo bhati na chandra tarakam nema vidyuto bhanti kuto yamagni. You want to know about him? Where the sun shines not, appears like a dark shadow, where the moon and the stars lose their luster and our electrical fires have no light there. You want to know about him? At whose table sages and heroes are food at his banquet, and I, death, am merely a spice in his food. He says, you want to know about him? And that movement stops there. It's very powerful. You know, the way that ends there is so abrupt and suddenness that, my God, you are left with just wondering that what is that being? So, behind all the professions of our love, so-called love, there is this sense of ego that we love ourselves and we want the other person to be like ourselves, at least a replica of ourselves, at least somebody who should feed my ego. And not only food we want ego to be fed more importantly. And if the ego is not fed, all this love which starts with running around the trees in the movie, and it, so you know, filmmakers are very smart. They will make movie till the marriage, even they don't show. Why? Because nobody likes to see tragedies. So running around the trees, everything is beautiful. But when two people start staying together, this egoistic element begins to come out. Oh, you love me, but you didn't do this for me. What about the morning cup of tea? Oh, this was not a pack. You're supposed to make it. Look at the American television. You know, it goes to absurd levels where love collapses because behind all this coloring, there is the egoistic love. But that's not the kind of love that Sri Aurobindo wants us to manifest as his children. But in a higher sense, it is the inner significance of that love too, which is not egoistic, but divine. So even in human relationships, in fact, all human relationships are very interestingly reflections of the way divine relates with creation, any relation. So we have another very interesting, sloka in Sanskrit. Acharid devo bhava, pitra devo bhava, matra devo bhava, deva devo bhava. It's very nice. And, you know, parents used to love to tell this to children to remind them. Acharya is like God. Don't forget. Touch his feet. Obey him. Pitra devo bhava, father is like God. Matra devo bhava, mother is like God. And you know, those days children listened, they had no choice. Now they revolt. So now children have twisted the meaning or turned the meaning to its true sense. So they say, yes, yes, acharya devo bhava, Acharya, be like a god. Don't behave like a human being. Gods have infinite patience. When gods teach us, look at the gods, they are laboring in creation's darkness since time sempiternal. Has any god ever run away? Sometimes they are in strange predicament, you know. Ganpati festival, you see the god going with all these hooligans dancing and jumping with alcohol and everything. Poor god has to sit there and endure. We will run away if we have such a horrible company. But gods have no choice, you know. So they are laboring in the darkness of creation since ages. And they don't run away. Sri Aurobindo at one place says, he has all the infinite patience of a father. Now, I am yet to find a father who has infinite patience. And all the infinite indulgent love of a mother. So, you know, an indulgent mother. So, the next thing that the children tell us, Pitra Devo Bhava, father, be like a god. Matra Devo Bhava, mother, be like a god. So, it is the inner sense on superficially that they are gods, so you better worship them. The other is that we have to become like God. All relations of human being have to be recreated in the image of the divine. How does divine deal with us as a father? How does the divine deal with us as a mother? If you really look at how mother deals with us, what an indulgent mother. So beautifully, you know, we read about Upanishads and, you know, Satyena Tapsa, Brahmacharyena Nitya. If you read those verses, you wonder whether, you know, any of us can even be adhikari to step into the yoga. Forget about doing it. Na yam atma pravachanena medha na bahuna shrutena yam veshe vranute tena labhyas tasye sa atma vivranute tanuswam. Then it says, na yam atma balhena. If you are weak, don't strive for this. It's not for you. Upanishads are so direct. Terse. We just wonder, can we ever strive for anything? So the divine says, well, I have one option. I will come as mother. So you cannot do it by yourself. Even when he came as master and friend and lover of mankind, Sri Krishna, and taught us that just surrender to me. Sarva dharman parityaja, Arjuna, because you are too intellectual, I have told you all these things. But you will forget them, you can't practice them, so I am giving you a secret. So, he gives the secret of the Upanishads in Gita. But he combines it to something which is not found in the Upanishads and the Vedas. And that is the secret of surrender. So, it's hinted but not brought out. So, Sri Krishna at the end says, Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam braja. I will deliver you. So, mother says, these guys cannot even surrender. They are beyond, you know. She says, just open to me. Nothing else is required. Just be receptive, be open, and I'll carry you through this. So you see, divine has so much patience. That is the way a mother should be able to love the child. That nothing is demanded, nothing is expected of you, and yet the love flows unconditionally. Similarly, with all the forms of love, love of a teacher, love of a friend and playmate, love of a beloved, all these love, master and servant, they must at a human level reflect something of the way divine deals with humanity. So, Sri Aurobindo says, all true love and all sacrifice are in their essence nature's contradiction of the primary egoism and its separative error. It is her attempt to turn from a necessary first fragmentation towards a recovered oneness. So, love is one of the powers which immediately reminds us that we are neither alone in this world, nor this world is created only for me. This lesson of life, one doesn't learn in a book. One doesn't learn through lectures, talks, contemplation. This lesson of life one learns by practicing true love in relationship. And by that act of giving, by that act of stepping out of the boundaries of the ego for the sake of another, so-called another, one gets the first lesson of sadhana. So, love is the teacher. And this will go on till the end. Right up to the end when the soul is merging into the divine. It is the act of self-giving through which we merge. Not by wanting the divine into ourselves. So, there are sadhanas where we pull the divine. We think that by our own efforts the divine can be revealed to us. Divine says, okay, try hard. So, we spend years and decades and we get nothing. Then after everything, we realize that this is too much beyond us. So one day, we abandon ourselves in a supreme gesture. Lord, this is beyond me. I have read everything, Synthesis, Vedas, Upanishad, Savitri, and you know, I can recite all the verses by heart, but Lord, I am just wanting a glimpse of that realization. I cannot by my own efforts. And when we have thus abandoned ourselves, that is the time that the grace comes, picks us up and reveals. So this first step of love in the nursery kindergarten class, where we begin to love another human being, must go on right up to the end. So many people who have not gone through these stages, often they speak about love the divine. Sri Aurobindo says in one of his aphorisms, men say that they love God, yet do not love men. Who are they in love with then? What is this love you are talking about? You cannot love one human being with freed of little bit egoism, and one talks about loving God, loving divine. He is so vast, so infinite. We do not love divine. When we say we love divine, we actually love our own image, our own shadow. We play with him. And we read yesterday, we only play with our own brilliant bonds. So we erect an image of the divine which is convenient for our purposes. A divine who will give us this way, that way and everything. And we love. And divine says, okay, play with it. So all true love is an act of giving. All unity between creatures is in its essence a self-finding, a fusion with that from which we have separated, and a discovery of one's own self in others. Now, Sri Aurobindo says something very interesting a little further, and Yeah. God bless you. If human relations as practiced now by man are full of smallness and perversity and ignorance, yet are they disfigured shadows of something in the divine. And by turning them to the divine, he finds that of which they are shadow and brings it down for manifestation in life. It's very amazing. You know, when we turn to the divine, either as a friend or as father, mother, beloved, then we really discover what it means to have these relations in human life. Because we discover how the divine in that particular relation deals with us. Even, you know, there are paths in yoga where we treat the divine as a child. Pushti mark, I am sure people are aware of it. In Vaishnava sect, there is a pushti mark where you treat the divine as a child. And I know of one family, this person used to actually treat him like a child. And I was amazed how he used to do the puja. So every day morning when he gets up, so normally we do puja after taking bath and brush and everything. No, first thing he will do is go to the temple and wake up baby Krishna. He is not supposed to even have a cup of tea because, you know, it's baby is more important. So, you know, that way he would continue. Very fine person, you know, a remarkable yogi. So, once I asked him, you turned to mother, and how did you turn to mother? And it must have been very difficult because, you know, he had a lineage of priest, that pushti mark. He said, well, my only problem with baby Krishna was I couldn't ask him anything. I said, he said, because the nature of relationship meant that I am only meant to give. One never asks from a child. Look what a beautiful lesson this is. We, in our egoistic love, expect the child to do things for us, fulfill our dreams and ambitions, which we could never do. And we call it that, isiliye pal poskar bada kiya, after all, that's why we have made you grow. This is not love for a child. This is love of myself. This is not love. But, child, you have grown up. Now you are free. Fly like a bird. Conquer the heavens. And hold the wide world in your own hands. I want nothing else from you but to see you soar in the highest heavens. Now this is love for a child. So he says, I can't ask anything from him. So it was a big problem for me. So then suddenly there was a set of circumstances because he had this difficulty inside. So he says, how the mother came into my life and now I am happy. Because with mother the relation is reversed. With mother you can only ask. Sri Aurobindo says at one place, that she has all the indulgent love of the mother, where the soul goes in all its pursuit. And he says, and the divine mother wants it to be so, because he cherishes this relationship. Now, can we imagine that it's not just people often ask, can I ask this from the mother? Can I ask that from the mother? Mother says, I like it, my child. Otherwise, you are making me a guru. Too far away, like a teacher. Says, I want you to come and ask me. So that I can pour my heart of love over you. See, the Bhagwan needs the Bhakta more than the Bhakta needs the Bhagwan. Because they fulfill each other. So we have this all relations coming through in the divine, of which they are shadows. It is through the human exceeding itself and opening itself to a supreme plenitude that the divine must manifest itself here. So this is how we have to express and manifest that love here, of which at this point these are the shadows. And then this final part which I wanted to read from the synthesis before we turn to Savitri. Now, you know, can a human love, this is a very interesting question. Can a human love actually, by its very power, you know, love for a human being can take you to the heights of divinity? This is a very interesting question. And in our Puranas, we find a mention of the ideal of Sati. Now, ideal of Sati is not burning in a fire. That's, of course, obviously, that came later and was a misrepresentation. But a woman, by her one pointed love towards one human being, whoever he may be, could develop such a tremendous force of tapasya in her. It was force of truth that regardless of who that stupid fellow would be, she would progress. And this was a great thing. You know, there is a very beautiful story recounted of Sati Anasuya. She is regarded as the highest of the, you know, among the Sati, she is the most, you know, most effulgent one. And there was a film shown about Anusuya in the ashram, and mother commented. She said, yes, it is very beautiful that Anusuya could even tame the gods. Such a power she had. The story runs like this, that once Narada is very smart, so he goes and tells, he wants to show all these great goddesses that you people think too much about yourself just because human beings worship you. But you know, they are greater than you. You just go and experience their struggle. You don't know what it means to run about in New York 1 hour. You are having your vanas which fly like this, you know, beyond time and space. So these goddesses say, what are you talking? Tell me one human being who is greater than us. Oh, you don't know. Anusuya, the way she loves her husband. You people cannot imagine loving your own gods. So now they are jealous. You know, suddenly they all change into green color. Z television, you know. So they finally come down to earth. We must test this lady Anusuya. Who is she? So they go and they are very smart. So when Anusuya's husband Atri Rishi is out, that's the time they knock. Anusuya opens. What do you want? They have dressed themselves, changed their form like a Brahmin. You know, we are Brahmins. We need to eat at your place some food if you have. See, come in. Yes, yes, sure, come in. They say, but we have one condition. Will you fulfill it? Then you tell us. Otherwise, we are not interested. Anusuya knows by her tapoval what the whole game is about. So she says, yes, what is your condition? Tell me, I'll fulfill it. She says, they say you have to disrobe yourself completely without any clothes on your body. Make us sit on your lap and feed us with your hands. Anusuya says, that's simple, no problem, come inside. Now it is the test of her love. So what she does, Anusuya, she goes, brings food. But in the meantime, by her tapobal, she changes them into little babies. Now, you know, they develop the consciousness of babies. Very gladly, she puts them on her thighs, feeds them, and then puts them to sleep. Now, meanwhile, the gods are missing. Where? So the goddesses get worried. Where did my husbands go? God knows what has happened on earth. Earth is a mysterious place. Even God sometimes can, you know, vanish. So they eventually come and zero in through their GPS system. They find Anusuya's place and ask her, you know, madam, three persons like this description. Says, well, I don't know. In my bedroom, there are three little babies sleeping. If you, they are your husbands, you can find them and take them away. So when mother was shown this film in the ashram, she says, yes, man can alone be greater than the gods because he is a psychic being inside. Only man can love like this. Human beings can love like this. They can express perfect love upon earth precisely because they have a psychic being which is like a little seed of the divine consciousness. And that is what we are meant to express. So these stories, and then there is a story where, okay, Anusuya's husband was a rishi. So it is easy to understand. You know, often where it is said, you know, why should I be like Sita? Let you become like Rama. This, of course, not a very not a very good thing, because Rama also abandoned Sita. But there is a story in the Puranas where Anusuya once, of course, Rama's abandonment of Sita is a symbolic thing. It's not the way it is, you know, projected. But the story of Anusuya is another story where there is an ordinary lady whose name even I have forgotten actually. And she loves her husband, who is ugly looking man who sleeps around with all kinds of, you know, people. And this woman, it's described that one night, you know, this man is desperate to go to another woman's place, and he craves her that, I cannot walk. Can you please carry me? She says, all right. She carries him on her shoulder. And as she is going, you know, there is something, and, you know, he says, hurry, hurry, because, you know, if I get late, it will be daybreak, and, you know, I won't be able to enjoy. So she says, oh, is that the thing? By the power of my tapasya, I ask the sun to wait. And the story goes that the sun is, you know, not able to now come out, because here is a woman with such a power of love inside her. So much so that Anusuya has to come and request her. Even by her power, she is not able to change it. She says, I understand your power and your love is unparalleled. But please, you have to understand that the whole creation cannot be punished for this man. So this is the power of love that human beings can embody. And Sri Aurobindo has a beautiful passage to it. All love, indeed, that is adoration, has a spiritual force behind it. All love, he is not distinguishing. That is adoration, has a spiritual force behind it. Even when it is offered ignorantly and to a limited object. Very often people, you know, go to limited deities, even, you know, gurus who may be of all kinds, and of course human beings. And yet, if there is true love of the nature of adoration, that becomes a power to carry us. So he says, even when it is offered to a limited object, something of that splendor appears through the poverty of the rite and the smallness of its issues. For love, that is worship, is at once an aspiration and a preparation. It can bring, even within its small limits in the ignorance, a glimpse of a still more or less blind and partial but surprising realization. Can you imagine the power? Mother has said, it says, it is the one power which can transform human nature. Within its limits, in a smallness of the circle, in a limited place, it can bring that. For they are moments when it is not we, but the one who loves and is loved in us. Look at the beauty of his revelation. And he goes still further. Look at how complete Sri Aurobindo's sentences are. You know, sometimes we wonder why he writes long sentences. Now we'll read, we are reading in bits, and then we'll read the full sentence. For there are moments when it is not we, but the one who loves and is loved in us. And even a human passion can be uplifted and glorified by a slight glimpse of this infinite love and lover. It is for this reason that the worship of the God, the worship of the idol, the human magnet or ideal are not to be despised, for these are steps through which the human race moves towards that blissful passion and ecstasy of the infinite, which, even in limiting it, they yet represent for our imperfect vision. When we have still to use the inferior steps nature has hewn for our feet and admit the stages of our progress. So, this is how we proceed in this great journey of love. To straightaway talk about loving the infinite, the vast, is impossible for human consciousness. But he says, even a human passion can be uplifted through this kind of a worship. It becomes a sacred act, a rite, and not just merely an act of passion play. So this is, you know, what we find again in Savitri, in that whole passage where Sri Aurobindo describes Savitri and Satyavan coming together. I'll read that part and then go on to what is that divine love and how it can express itself. In the Book of Love, Sri Aurobindo describes even human love, which comes so close to something divine. And we normally don't read this passage, you know, for some reason, I don't know why, but it's amazing how Sri Aurobindo describes. This coming together of Satyavan and Savitri, what an ideal of human love changed into something divine, lifted to the heights. It's very interesting when you read in Savitri the description Sri Aurobindo gives in the author's note. He says it is a story of conjugal love conquering death. It's very interesting. Conjugal love conquering death, we can understand it's a symbol of divine love conquering death. But here is a story of conjugal love, human love. Conjugal love is a human love with all its human sense in it. And yet this love has the power to conquer death. Can human beings love in such a way that it can conquer death? So here is the possibility, and here we have such a human description. This is page 410. She bowed and touched his feet with worshipping hands. See what we read just now, that, you know, when love changes into an adoration. She made her life his world for him to tread, and made her body the room of his delight, her beating heart a remembrance of bliss. He bent to her and took into his own. Their married yearning joined like folded hopes, as if a whole rich world, suddenly possessed, wedded to all he had been, became himself. An inexhaustible joy made his alone. He gathered all Savitri into his clasp. It's very interesting. When human beings embrace, this simple gesture, is it just a physical act? Very often, you know, people turn it into just a physical act or a casual thing. Like everything, touching feet is, nowadays, thank God it is gone, because, you know, people don't touch feet, they just do this gesture and it's so each act of the body is symbolic of a deep inner truth, and it can become like that if we can really, because this body contains the gods inside, and every gesture, this was the whole science developed by the ancient Indians, where every not just vichar but achar and vihwar, conduct, was meant to express a divine truth, like namaskar. So namaskar was a divine truth. I bow down to the divine inside you. Then, of course, touching the feet. Even when the dead is, you know, dead body, we bow down and do pranam. So why do we do pranam to the dead? He cannot say that bye, goodbye. After all, he is gone. He is, you know, if you take a materialistic view of science, anyways, he can't even see what you are doing. No. Whom do we bow down to? We are not bowing down to just a human being, and it's not a courtesy call. We bow down to the Dehi inside, who has gone through this whole journey of life, endured and struggled, and eventually now he is leaving. So we bow down to that presence inside, who has accepted, and, you know, it's a recognition of ourselves in the other person. So every gesture, so here Sri Aurobindo is describing the gesture where the two come together. And he says he gathered all Savitri into his clasp. It's not just a physical act. Around her, his embrace became the sign of a locked closeness through slow, intimate years. A first sweet summary of delight to come. And then he describes this whole act in terms which are deeply spiritual. In a wide moment of two souls that meet, she felt her being flow into him as in waves, a river pours into a mighty sea, as when a soul is merging into God, to live in him forever and know his joy. Her consciousness was a wave of him alone, and all her separate self was lost in his. So this is like a training ground where human experience of life is a training ground for that eventual infinity which we have to become. So if we like to skip the steps, we may try it, but it's difficult. At one place somebody asked the mother, mother, what do we do when human love comes in our life? So mother gave a very interesting answer. In fact, the question is very well phrased. One has to congratulate the person who asked this question. So the question was, mother, we are supposed to love only the divine. So what do we do if human love comes in our way, in our life? So mother gave a very interesting answer. She says, go through it. And then there is laughter. And then she explains. It's a whole passage in Collected Works of the Mother, volume 8. It's page 301. Read the full thing. 1956 question answer. She says, you know, if you go through it in the right way, you can make tremendous progress. So what is the right way? She says, learn to love unselfishly. And if you just practice it without expectations, at one place she says, there is no other right of love except to love. She says, people talk about rights of love. It's my right. I love him or her so much. She must do this for me. He says, you have gone, lost the battle. He says, there is no other right of love but love alone. So it's only privileges to love and love unselfishly. Then she says, if you do it, it's difficult. She says that it's very difficult. So she says, first says, when human love comes and people deny it, then what happens? She says, sometimes people lose often the capacity to love itself. They become very harsh. And sometimes they have to take lives to recover even this capacity to love. Because, you know, the nature becomes very harsh. It has not allowed this power to grow inside. She says, on the other hand, if you love unselfishly, then over a period of time, you will eventually pierce behind appearances and you will touch the divine principle of love in things. You will cut through all the layers and coats and you will touch the divine principle. Because you are, you know, every time expectation, she says it's a very difficult path, but she says it is much more complete. If you can go through it, it will be really a complete path. It's not that it is highly recommended because it's a difficult path, no doubt about it. But we should know that there is a possibility like that existing in human nature. And if human being wants, everything can be turned towards a divine living. So this is the height to which just human love can rise. Even human passion can rise to those heights which are unimaginable. And then we can, you know, turn to what exactly is this love when it rises through all these heights? What kind of love it becomes? What is the transformation that takes place inside? Because we have learned that human love must change its human ways to ways divine. What is the divine way of love? So that's where I feel why the life of Mother and Sri Aurobindo is important. Very often, what is there to know about their life? Why not we just, you know, read their books? Now, in the Gita, there is something very interesting where Sri Aurobindo says, Krishna tells Arjuna, my life itself is an example. Arjuna, look at me. There is nothing that I have to gain from any of the three worlds. Yet, I continue to work. Because if I don't work, all these worlds will collapse. And the divine gives his example. And Sri Aurobindo emphasizes on this, the divine's own example. That is how he emphasizes. So, of course, obviously, the true sense of that life should come out. So what is, only mother can show us how to love truly. And here are some of her lines. And there are so many stories. One story that comes to my mind is Dilip Kumar Roy. We know that he kept having doubts about the mother. And so much so that it's now well known that he even wrote to Indira Gandhi against, I think it was Nehru, sorry, against the mother. And yet, look at the mother side of the story. 51, he left the ashram, went away. For 14 years, mother kept his room. And she would not give it to anyone. When people asked her that, mother, why don't you give this room, this naturally? She says, my child, he may come back. And then she says, every night his soul comes to rest here. Only she could have that vision to see. Every night his soul comes to rest here in this room. How can I give it to somebody? Where will he find the place if he comes? This was her love. That on one side here is a disciple, errant, moving away. And on the other side there is the divine. How she is loving. And this we find in the description of Savitri, which is none else but the Divine Mother, and she is an embodiment of love. We can look at Mother as embodiment of this, an embodiment of that, but of all the things, all the powers, the Mother is ultimately the embodiment of love. So what is that love? Love came to her hiding the shadow, death. So beautiful it is. To Savitri, love comes hiding the shadow, death. It comes in front as love, but what it is hiding? Death. And why it comes in this way? Well, might he find in her his perfect shrine. Those who are born for greatness are given the greatest difficulties and challenges. So if one's life is sometimes a bit too easy, you know, this Prapatti, when Prapatti was from Odisha, and Prapatti and Babaji Maharaj did a lot of work in Odisha. So when somebody told him, my life is so good and, you know, Mother is so kind and everything. So he said, maybe Mother has not yet looked at you till now. So who is given the greatest challenges of life? Somebody who is being prepared to scale heights. At one place, Mother says that every time you have to make a progress, you are given a test. And only when you pass through it, then you are ready. So he who has to manifest perfect love must also face its very opposite and contradiction. So love came to her hiding the shadow, death. Well, might he find in her his perfect shrine. Since first the earth beings heavenward growth began, through all the long ordeal of the race, never a rarer creature bore his shaft, that burning test of the Godhead in our parts, a lightning from the heights to our abyss. It's difficult to contain this power, burning test of Godhead in our parts. This is a power which, as another place he says, love is a glory from the eternity's sphere, abased, disfigured. We have those lines written, I think, in the card. Yet it is the Godhead by which all can change. Mother says that, my child, it is only love that can transform, nothing else can transform. So what was in her that love found? It is very interesting. So that we can try to be just a little like this. It's very difficult to be like this, but just a little. So Sri Aurobindo describes Savitri, why love came to her. All in her pointed to a nobler kind. Now he is describing a human aspect of Savitri. But look at this human aspect. All in her pointed to a nobler kind. Near to earth's wideness, intimate with heaven. On one side, she knew everything about the earth. She was not just, you know, love means she is living in some mystic trance. When a child would go to her with, you know, there's that story about how that child went, and, you know, there were people standing in the queue, but for a long time this child is not coming out. And people are wondering that, Mother, there is a big person waiting to meet you and he's getting very restless. Mother says, yes, but this child has come, her frock, there is an ink stain. So she is cleaning that ink stain with her own hands. Look at the Divine Mother's play. And then giving her nice sweets, chocolates, and then sending the child, making her happy. Maupati, you are fine. I mean, one cannot imagine. Small, small details. How she used to go near to earth's wideness. How the earth supports everything. Sri Aurobindo gives this example. How everything it encourages to grow. Earth doesn't say, oh, you, I will not support you. You are a snake. No. Earth gives itself food for the snake. Earth gives shelter to the lion. Earth supports human beings. Everything it allows to grow. Even poison weeds as well as the, you know, herbs. So it allows near to earth's wideness, intimate with heaven. Yet it keeps the vision of the beyond always. Exalted and swift, her young, large vision spirit, voyaging through worlds of splendor and of calm, overflew the ways of thought to unborn things. Even at a human level, this power has come to her from above. Her thoughts are always focused, flying towards unborn things. Ardent was her self-poised, unstumbling will. You know, often people say, oh, love and all, it's an emotion, you know, is for weak fellows. Here, Shobindu says the reverse. Only the strong and mighty can love. What is the nature of her will? Ardent was her self-poised, unstumbling will. Only such a person can love. Otherwise, first very test and the person starts faltering like this. Her mind, a sea of white sincerity, passionate in flow, had not one turbid wave. Then another capacity. This capacity for love can only come from truth. This is the other part that Sri Aurobindo reveals. As in a mystic and dynamic dance, a priestess of immaculate ecstasies, inspired and ruled from truth's revealing vault, moves in some prophet given of the gods, a heart of silence in the hands of joy. So this is the second part, that love is does not mean that we compromise and we start and indulging in falsehood, simply please people. It's not, that is not love. Look at Mandodari. She loved Ravana. Even though Ravana kept his wayward ways, but Mandodari always spoke the truth. Always she would tell him, Ravana, don't do this. This is not the right path you are following. This is not the path to Dharma. Surrender to Rama. He is the Lord. He is the divine incarnate. He will release you. She would always tell him the path of the right and the light. She would not tell lies just to please him. She could have been, you know, Ravana was a big threat, terror. I mean, he could have simply said, Mandodari, you are talking too much. You know, I am filing papers. So, enough. You lose the kingdom. I have enough people who will come to me. But that power of truth in her prevented Ravana from, you know, doing it. Because somewhere he knew that whatever it is, she is ruled by truth. The same power of truth we find in Sita's love. Look at it like, you know, when, and these stories when you read, you sometimes feel are they exaggerations, but as you grow, you realize that they are not exaggerations, they are facts of inner truth. So when Ravana wants to come near Sita, Sita says, you want to come near me? She picks up a trin, just like the Ken Upanishad story. She picks up a blade of grass. She says, try crossing this line. If my love for Rama is true, you dare not cross this. Now this fellow is shaken. This woman who has the guts to say that if my love for Rama is true, you dare not cross this line. Who can say this? So, inspired by truth's revealing vault. Few lines below. And the third aspect of love is beauty and delight. So, all gestures. A person who truly loves does not need to have a moral code. This is the beauty. One who loves will know it by a sense of beauty, aesthetic sense inside what is to be done and what is not to be done. His ethics is inside. You don't have to tell, do this, don't do this. Because the power of love will reveal. A person who truly loves will never do something which is ignoble, which is small, petty, you know, ugly, because that power will stop. Her look, her smile evokes celestial sense, even in earth stuff. And their intense delight poured a supernal beauty on men's lives. At one place, the mother says, my child, I always look up towards light, towards truth. If I start seeing your defects, you will not, none of you will stand in front of me. She says, never invoke justice. Ask for grace. Who will stand before justice? She says, if I start seeing, you know, that the other day we were talking about Tulsidas, those lines, Ram so Swami ko sevak moso. That it's only by looking at your own capacity for grace that you can keep me near you. But if you look at my faults and defects, no way. I don't stand a chance. So she was always looking towards truth, towards light. She said, my child, I know everything that is happening. Even that famous story about a spy who was there in the ashram. And ISI spy. And he would come and suddenly like this, you know, bow down towards mother. And then mother kept him. Then one day the police came and took him away. So they asked, mother, why did you keep him near you? Says, my child, when he would come, his soul would step out and pray for protection. What do I do? I have to protect him as long as ultimately his destiny will take over. But how she gathered So all that she was doing constantly is pouring love, beauty on human life everywhere. And through that love and beauty, she was changing human life. A wide self-giving was her native act. A magnanimity as of sea or sky, enveloped with its greatness all that came and gave a sense as of a greatened world. And so people lost their heads, because everybody felt, mother has given me so much love, I must be special. So, you know, this is the best way to come to the abyss. Divine sometimes by his act of love, because when people begin to feel there is something must be special about me, not realizing divine's nature is to love. Whoever goes to the divine, he will love. He will give love, make you feel you are greatened, because simply because he sees that part in us, that little being no bigger than the thumb of man. And it sees its possibility and encourages it. So there were people, you know, we have so many instances, better not to speak about them, but how she saw one possibility and she would pour love to allow it to grow. Once someone asked mother, you know, so many people you have gathered in the ashram, I mean there's some useless people, they do no work, and better, you know, why don't you take them off from the ashram? So mother says, why don't you make a list of these people, so I'll consider it. So the person made a list of about 25 persons. So she would say this, no, he does this well, he does this, that. Finally it came to somebody, he said, what about this man? Oh, you know, when he puts stamps, he puts them so neatly. So she would see that, I mean, it's not that she has not sent away people from ashram, but that also, she was only seeing the good of the person. That by doing this, he has a chance to probably revive his psychic and spiritual life. It was not an act of punishment. We have those lines in the mother where she says, even her rejections are not a rejections, but a postponement. They are not a punishment. She would never punish. Even when we see sent away, there are instances of people who were sent away from the ashram. Somebody who lost his head or somebody became very wayward, but yet her love would go behind. On one side she is sending, on the other side the love is going to protect. A famous instance of a boy who studied in the ashram school, and he became a little wayward, took to drugs, and you know, eventually had to be sent away. So he came to mother, and mother told him something, and nobody knew what she has told. He went in his wayward ways, and eventually ended up with the rehab center with cancer, and eventually he died. So his father was telling me that how he got reassured. You know, it's a painful thing for a parent to see all this. He shared that how he got reassured when he met this boy much later. Much later means he was following him, but on his deathbed, he had cancer and it had spread. So he said, finally I got reassured that doesn't matter, mother is carrying him. When I asked him that you went through all this and I'm sure you must have learnt at least your lesson in life, he says, yes, I have learnt it. Then he asked him, what kept you going? He said, the mother told me two things. One was, never hide anything from me. And then she said, my child, wherever you go, remember that mother loves you. Now, on one side he is going out. On the other side she is telling him, remember, the mother loves you. This power of love has such a capacity. It sustained him through all the trials and tribulations, ups and downs, the hellish curves and the abysses of his journey. So this is her nature. Her kindly care was a sweet, temperate sun. What kindly care? Once Vijay Bhai was recounting this story that he had been given a cycle by the mother, and when he, you know, this must have been around 7 years of age, then suddenly one day when on his 12th birthday, after 5 years, there was an announcement that the mother wanted him to see him. So what for? She had bought a new cycle for him and said, that must have grown small for you. Can we imagine? This is divine mother. She should be only concerned about sadhana and tell him, how are you doing? Are you sitting for meditation and doing your prayers? No. And sometimes people could not conceive. In fact, when you ask some of these sadhaks, they say, we were so mesmerized just by her human love that we could not see the divine aspect. Because her human care itself was so much, so loving, that for the smallest things, she would not miss out. Kindly care was a sweet and temperate sun. Look at the line, sweet and temperate sun. Not the sun which is blazing hot. When you read Sri Aurobindo's writings, you feel it is the supramental sun in all its glory, shining at mid-noon in the Sahara where not a soul can survive. But what she does? The same supramental sun tailors itself to our level. It becomes sweet and temperate. Makes us feel warm and pleasant. It's the same light, same truth, same power, same glory, but veiled and limited. Because these children will not understand, you know, big things. So, but they will understand human love. But human love, when the divine gives, he passes on his divinity through that human touch. So, her kindly care was a sweet, temperate sun. Her high passion, a blue heaven's equipoise. And now these marvelous lines, which, you know, are one of my favorite ones. As might a soul fly like a hunted bird, escaping with tired wings from a world of storms, and a quiet reach like a remembered breast in a haven of safety and splendid soft repose. One could drink life back in streams of honey fire, recover the lost habit of happiness. If somebody asked me, describe the ashram, these are the lines I would use. What is the ashram? Her lap, physically manifested. What do we find here? There, safety and splendid soft repose. A kind of safety one can find nowhere upon earth. When Woodrow Wilson's daughter, Nishtha, renamed Nishtha, she was very sick, and we know, I mean, she was sick much before, and then she was asked, all the president and his men, that why don't you come back in India? Who can take care of you? And, you know, in America we have new things which we have discovered, all kinds of medicines and all kinds, as if people would never die here. You know, there's an absurdity in all this, of course. Amar lok to nahi hai. But, you know, why don't you come here and we'll take care of you? The kind of care which cannot be provided there. What a lovely feeling she expressed. Says, yes, yes, maybe you can take care of my body in a better way, but who will take care of my soul? This is the expression. So that care in a haven of safety and splendid soft repose. You go there and you just feel that, you know, pahunch gaye, first thing, go to samadhi and you feel done. Ganga na liye. Everything is gone in a haven of safety and splendid soft repose. One could drink life back in streams of honey fire. Recover the lost habit of happiness. With all the problems, troubles, difficulties, you have a smile on the face and a joy in the heart. That is what her embrace is. A deep of compassion, a hushed sanctuary, her inward help unbarred a gate in heaven. She says, my child, whoever I have seen even once, I never forget him. Even those who have turned and gone away, even those who are hostile, I continue to help them in their journey. I never forget them. The whole world, love in her was wider than the universe. The whole world could take refuge in her single heart. 71 onwards, mother would not take anybody in the ashram. So she would say, my child, you know, if I could, I would have the whole world here. She knew this is going to happen. But my means are limited. But yes, inwardly, wherever you are, you have my grace, you have my protection. So if she says, if I had the means, I would have the whole people, whole world near me physically. But it's not possible because, you know, there are limitations of time and space. So she says, the whole world could take refuge in her single heart. And now Sri Aurobindo summarizes the power of love, who could, why it could find home in her. Love in her was wider than the universe. The whole world could take refuge in her single heart. The great unsatisfied Godhead here could dwell. He found here its home. Ah, This is the heart, so vast, full of sacrifice, full of giving, full of magnanimity, doesn't calculate anything, unconditional love. Here I can find my home. Vacant of the dwarf selves imprisoned here. We have those lines from Kabir, so beautiful. Prem gali ati sankari, tame dona samahi. Jab main tha, tab hari nahi. Jab hari, tab main nahi. Vacant of the dwarf selves imprisoned here. We cannot love, whether it be divine or anybody, as long as we live in a small consciousness, narrow consciousness, imprisoned consciousness. By its nature, love is not satisfied with that. You build a wall around it, it says, where am I? Break the wall. That advertisement, I don't know, yahan aata hai ki nahi, India TV mein aata hai. Pehle, brothers would build a diwal. Now the advertisement comes that suddenly they realize that, you know, they love each other and say, bhaiya, ye diwar ko tod do. So they try to smash it. But unfortunately, it's an advertisement of Ambuja cement. Ki diwar to... that wall is not breaking. Inwardly, they have reconciled. So love ka problem yehi hai. It doesn't, is not satisfied with walls, boundaries. Now if you see why this power can take us to the infinite. Because limitless, infinite, every finite boundary love will smash. It is not happy with it. So only the boundless can truly love. Her mood could harbor his sublimer breath, spiritual, that can make all things divine. For even her gulfs were secrecies of light. And now in four lines we have a summary of our Divine Mother, what her nature is. And just the human aspect, so powerful. At once, she was the stillness and the word. She was at once both these things. When we look at Sri Aurobindo, looks like infinite stillness. How will we reach him? We can drown ourselves in his two lotus eyes. But when we look at Mother, on one side, stillness. But a tremendous power coming through that stillness. People say this. When they were in presence of Sri Aurobindo, they felt that, you know, there is infinity around. But in presence of Mother, they felt that same infinity was pressing them to change. At once, he was the stillness and the word. A continent of self-diffusing peace. An ocean of untrembling virgin fire. The strength, the silence of the gods were hers. And then Sri Aurobindo says, in her he found a vastness like his own. Love doesn't dwell in small hearts. In her he found a vastness like his own. His warm, subtle ether he refound and moved in her as in his natural home. In her he met his own eternity. This is the kind of consciousness that human beings have to embody. This is the change before we can really harbor the sublime breath of that love, which is what we are meant to. This is the vastness from which we are supposed to or expected to love, not just God, but the whole creation. So, we'll pause here and any questions we can take up. Yes, but limited by the consciousness that it inhabits. And it constantly labors to break those prison walls. So, it's like the light, the same light, when we put a, you know, dark mantle around it, so it changes its color. So, all love is essentially only one love. Even love at the most animal or worm-like level or even below it. We'll talk about that tomorrow. But essentially, it is the nature of the consciousness which conditions and limits is. But there is only one love. There is no two love in this universe.
Part of the same self-law, or is like when you are giving such a nice discourse, from. So is it again my own ego, or is I should be, you know, in the divine love and say, son, do whatever you want to do, I will just
No, it's a very, very beautiful question, I must say, and a very practical one, not always an easy one to answer, because it will depend on many things. But to put it in, let me not be diplomatic, that it will depend on many things. Let me come straight to the point, both as a psychologist and as a practitioner of yoga. And a father, yes. So, you see, ego is there in human nature. Now, sattvic ego quite naturally wants others. If one has cultivated a certain sattvic self-culture, one quite naturally wants the child to practice that. The way for that is through one's own example. So one good part is that you have, you know, the child has your example. You know, he sees you coming, and that is the first step that you have already taken. This, it's perfectly valid to tell the child what is best in your vision about him. But it is perfectly invalid to insist on it, because that's where you have to allow the scope. So on one side, one extreme is freedom, where, oh, let him do whatever he wants. Now that will not be the right approach. But at the same time, if one insists, why, it's practically also a problem, because many times when there is a possibility, you know, it's a paradox of life, that when there is an insistence, sometimes there is a resistance for no reason at all. You see, that's what people say, that they don't want actually the freedom to do certain things. They want to have the freedom to make a choice whether they want to do it or not. Now, the moment there is an insistence, then children tend to, you know, react. Not all children, but some children. The second is that they have to eventually choose their own freedom. So, suggest, maybe advise, maybe time to time give that subconscious suggestions. Like, for instance, a much better way will be, oh, it was wonderful. And if, you know, again as a father, you can also say some nice things, that, oh, it was so nice, you know, there was this story, no untruth things. And the cookies were wonderful. So maybe, you know, next time the child may not come for the lecture, but comes for the cookies. Or, you know, just the feeling, you express a sense of joy, and the child may feel drawn. Maybe, you know, it's something worth going. Like many times for Pondicherry, when, you know, children, parents ask me, I say, don't tell them that you are going to a spiritual place, an ashram where, you know, they will learn some big things. Just say that Park Guest House is a lovely place by the side of the sea, and they will enjoy a good holiday. Now, you know, when they come with that consciousness, and you're not telling a lie, because that's a fact. Now, when they come with that, they get, you know, into this. So, for each level of consciousness, the message has to go in an appropriate way. They shrink because they have this idea that, I'm generalizing the question, not confining it to, you know, this only problem. Children have their own idea about, you know, divinity, spirituality, and etc. And partly we are responsible for it, because we make it appear like something very stiff, like a moral code, like, set of do's and don'ts. And they suddenly feel there will be a lot of restrictions upon me. Or, you know, we talk about meditation, etc. But when we talk about the love of the divine, this is something which can hook them on, because they feel, oh, there is something which I am going to get, which is what I want, but something far, far greater in quality. So slowly it is through that they would turn. And having said that, yet in the last analysis, they will have their own destiny. So the last thing which one should do is offer it, whatever you feel or aspire for your child, which you are doing out of your own love and goodwill, definitely. But keep offering the child and his destiny to the divine. Tell the mother that, look, before he is my child, he is your child. If he goes wayward, your problem. Don't blame me that I didn't do. I have done my bit. Now you take care of your child. So this way the child gets connected with parents as a intermediary link with our own highest, that, you know, that Pitra Devo Bhava, with that highest divine figure of which we are a shadow. So we are trustees and shadows. So what should the shadow do? Refer back to the light. Now, if a child is not directly able to relate with the divine as father and mother, then as the human representatives, human father and human mother, we can connect, because he is connected to us through bond of love, through bond of birth, and through bond of various kind. So when we connect to the divine mother every day in our prayers, we can say, mother, along with me and my wife or my husband, here is one more fellow who is absent here, but in your consciousness he is ever present, so please take care of him. Do it every day and you will see it makes a difference. I mean, I know people who do it and who have done it and it makes a difference. Even in things which may, and because the divine works in strange ways. He doesn't need him to come here. See, you have connected, like prayer, you have connected the child's consciousness with the divine. Now, how he will do, because he knows every nature, he knows all the, you know, nuts and bolts. So, he will create circumstances, situations, and how he will do it, leave it to him. And he will do it. Because he is not limited.
It's not that the father has already failed whenever he says, son, come. He has failed to win him completely so that whatever he says, he will do.
No, I don't think that is a correct assessment. Also, I feel, you know, sometimes it's not good for a child to become a replica of the father. Because each child must follow his own destiny's curve and his own nature. And that's the other part. In fact, that would be egoistic love, where I want my child to become like my image. You know, it would not be good.
That was not the point, the love or whatever it is, that whatever my father is saying is good for me and I would enjoy it. You know,
well, it has both sides. It has both sides. Sometimes it may also mean that the child is losing his own capacity to think and decide. So, you know, it can work both ways. By and large, it's better if children make their own choices and not necessarily based on what the parents say, because after all, we are ignorant. As parents, none of us can claim that we live in that light where we know what is really best. So, what I may think is best from my standpoint may not be the best for a child's standpoint. There is a famous, you remind me of a actual incident where someone wrote to Sri Aurobindo about his daughter, and he described the experiences she was having and that she wants to come to the ashram, and he said it will be very great if you could, you know, accept her and, you know, she could be a part of the ashram. Sri Aurobindo wrote back that, yes, I can see that she is blossoming very beautifully in her soul, but if she comes here, suddenly her difficulties will increase and she is likely to get stifled in her progress. It's much better that she stays there and she will receive all the help. Now, you see, divine has seen something which as a parent one could not see. As a parent going near the ashram, and I am talking of the period when Sri Aurobindo and the mother are there in their physical body. But Sri Aurobindo sees it very differently. So, as parent or as human beings, as anybody, I always feel a fundamental thing about progress is that we should have that utter humility that at the end of the day, I really don't know. I mean, I am thinking that this is best, but it may not be the best. Some children have to go through their own experiences. Sri Aurobindo's own life. His father wanted something about him and therefore he sent him there. And you know, it turned in another way. Same with Buddha's life. So, it's true that we should tell the child, that's why perhaps we have come in his life. But for whatever reason, whether it's a, you know, either lack of assertion or trust, whatever issue there may be, there can be a whole host of issues. We should eventually leave it the final choice the child should learn to make, and it will help him in the long run much more. And we really don't know what is really best for him. So we should offer it at the feet of the divine and connect him to the divine. And that our task is over. Beyond it, it's one own destiny. I mean, all of us have to go through our own errors and mistakes and ups and downs. And there is no perfect life. Yes, child. Very beautiful. So to start with, as I said, it's not that it is invalid. It is imperfect and incomplete. So what we should do is ask him that this is how I love you. But I really don't know who you are and what is the best way to love. You know, Champak Lal ji, after years of serving mother and Sri Aurobindo with an, you know, unflinching spirit of service, tells mother, mother, all my life I have served you the way I have wanted to serve you. Now you tell me how you want me to serve you. So, you know, ask him and he will, when you are ready, because, you know, it's very difficult. Nachiketa asks, no, this question, that tell me the true divine. So death says, I am a spice in his banquet, you will be shaken up. Arjuna asked this question and Arjuna could not contain that vision. So he will reveal, but in his own course of time. Ask this, that I don't want to just love an image. I want to love you as you are. But in the beginning, this approach is valid and valid, very valid for a long, long time. So don't worry about it. When the time comes, if you are connecting to the divine, he himself will reveal to you who he is or what he is, or, you know, the totality and the vastness. So we should not worry about it. But we should know. Because what happens is, in life, many times our conceptions of the divine are broken by events and circumstances. Now, that time we should remember, maybe it's an, you know, after all, it's a conception. Maybe the divine way of doing things is very different. So always keep that margin, that I cannot understand everything of the divine, however much I may have read, understood or realized. But there will always remain something of the divine which will escape my understanding. That is the reason why we should remember this, that whatever I am worshipping, loving, is a conception given to me at this point of time. But it is not the ultimate and the final truth. That must always remember, that there will always remain something of the divine which will be like a mystery beyond human understanding. That's one must know. Yes, Priya. Shrunk suddenly. And too early. That's right. So, you know, we leave it, we learn to surrender. Only we should know that all that I may know or speak or read about the divine, yet something of the divine will always remain a mystery. And that makes it very wonderful, actually. Because, you know, there is always the sense of something yet not realized, and it makes you always youthful because you are constantly progressing. That's why. Yes.
So how do you know the difference between when you're had like an egotistical love and just if you're on your like
true love? Yeah. Yes, egoistic love will constantly make you unhappy and the other fellow unhappy. Very soon this love will become a point of bitterness, unhappiness, quarrel in life. But true love, to start with, a part of you will feel pained. But every time you overcome that barrier, because you know, you will realize that within you there is an ego operating, you will feel a sense of release and a liberation. So to start with, it will make you feel that within you, love is becoming wider and wider. And your consciousness is becoming wider and wider, more stronger, more, you know, powerful in the movement of love, and therefore it will also release a greater joy in your being. True love will always increase the joy of your being, whereas all pain, all bitterness, all quarrel is a sign that it's an egoistic love.
How would you present true love to the divine? Like, how
do you give yourself in one word? Any love, whether it is to the divine or a human being, it's an act of giving. When we are wanting, then we are really not loving truly. But it's allowed. Not that it's not allowed. But when we give oneself to the divine, then we have really begun to love in the true way. So we should give ourselves to the divine. Here I am. And with all my, whatever I think are good and whatever others think are bad, or vice versa, a human creature, a bundle of all kinds of things, and here I am, I present myself at your feet. Do with me whatever best you can do. And then the divine will begin to take charge of your life and start changing you. You know, this story, another thing about, you know, just as an aside, how our conception of what may be good and the divine's way of looking may be very different. One story that comes to my mind is when a group of people had come from abroad, I forget which country, and mother asked Ambu Bhai to talk to them about the yoga. Now Ambu Bhai was a heart yogi, not Ambu Purani, not Abhi Purani, but Ambu Bhai was a heart yogi, and he was not much of, you know, like a person with much thought or anything. So he said, mother, what you are giving me, you should ask Kamal Kiran, or, you know, there are such stalwarts, Udar, and they will tell all the things about yoga, about supermind, overmind. I know nothing, mother. Why you are asking me to talk to them about yoga? She said, precisely because Amal Kiran and these people will tell them much more than they can assimilate or they are ready for. That's why I want you to. I can. And then she says something very remarkable. I can make use of your ignorance. You see, our human conceptions, like normally one would say, oh, somebody has come from there, send him to Amal Kiran. Human beings would do that. Send them to Amal Kiran. He is the, you know, person who can really tell them everything. But mother didn't do that. She said, send them to Ambu Bhai. And Ambu Bhai was totally at loss. He said, of all the people, you are asking me to talk to them? I mean, those who know him know he had a very simple consciousness with no understanding about yoga, etc. He said, but I want you. Because you will not tell them more than what is needed. I'll make use of your ignorance. That's why the divine makes use of everything. Nirodbaran, that's what. Yeah, when he says that, Nirodha says that, I don't know why he chose me. He should have chosen Amal Kiran to be the scribe. Then he says, perhaps I understand because I don't understand much of poetry. Otherwise, Amal Kiran would keep thinking, why is using this, why not that? So, precisely because I don't have that thing in me, so he asked me, you write. This fellow will quietly write. Otherwise, already as in Vyasa Avatar, Sri Aurobindo must have experienced that keeping Ganesha as a scribe is very difficult. Because this fellow must understand everything before he writes. That's why Vyasa had to compose some verses which were so cryptic that even Ganesha took time to understand, and that's the time when he could compose new ones. So this time he changed his strategy. He said, no Ganesha, but someone simpler will do. One of the Ganas will do. Write the Mahabharata? No, I really don't know. It's a good question. But only thing what is mentioned as a fact is, it won't have taken long because there are 24,000 verses in the original. It's very interesting also because in Savitri there are nearly 24,000 lines. So there are 24,000 verses in the original Mahabharata. So if you really look at it like that, Vyasa could have composed it in a matter of weeks. But we went to that place where Vyasa's that gufa is there in Badrinath where Vyasa is supposed to have written. This is also a place where Ganesh used to rest at night. So I guess it took definitely more than one day because, you know, there is a place where he would rest at night. And but the worst part is by the side, or not by the side, but Vyas gufa is there. Then there is Ganesh gufa, and then there is India's last tea stall where you sell Coca-Cola and... So, I don't think it would have taken very long, in my understanding. Yes, please. Years. 3 years. I don't know. Maybe if you have read it somewhere. I mean, possible. But somehow I find 3 years, unless he kept perfecting it, quite possible. I mean, maybe even more years. I mean, it all depends on how the inspiration flowed. Because it's a highly inspired poem, that's no doubt. Okay, yeah. Okay, sure. I'll read on the theme of love, but it elsewhere. What kind of people the mother called near her, what love she gave. Book 4, Canto 2, 364. A being they loved, whose bounds exceeded theirs. Her measure they could not reach, but bore her touch, answering with the flower's answer to the sun. They gave themselves to her and asked no more. One greater than themselves, too wide for their ken, their minds could not understand, nor wholly know. Their lives replied to hers, moved at her words. They felt a godhead and obeyed a call, answered to her lead and did her work in the world. Their lives, their natures moved compelled by hers, as if the truth of their own larger selves put on an aspect of divinity to exalt them to a pitch beyond their earths. They felt a larger future meet their walk. She held their hands. She chose for them their paths. They were moved by her towards great unknown things. Faith drew them, and the joy to feel themselves hers. They lived in her. They saw the world with her eyes. Some turned to her against their natures bent, divided between wonder and revolt, drawn by her charm and mastered by her will, possessed by her, her striving to possess. Impatient subjects, their tied longing hearts, hugging the bonds close of which they most complained, murmured at a yoke they would have wept to lose, the splendid yoke of her beauty and her love. Others pursued her with life's blind desires, and claiming all of her as their lonely own, hastened to engross her sweetness meant for all. As earth claims light for its lone separate need, demanding her for their soul jealous clasp, they asked from her movements bounded like their own, and to their smallness craved its like response. Or finding her touch desired too strong to bear, they blamed her for a tyranny they loved, shrank into themselves as from too bright a sun, yet hankered for the splendor they refused, angrily enamored of her sweet passionate ray, the weakness of their earth could hardly bear. They longed, but cried out at the touch desired, inapt to meet divinity so close, intolerant of a force they could not house. Some drawn unwillingly by her divine sway, endured it like a sweet but alien spell, unable to mount to levels too sublime. They yearned to draw her down to their own earth, or forced to center round her their passionate lives. They hoped to bind to their hearts human needs, her glory and grace that had enslaved their souls. But mid this world, these hearts that answered her call, none could stand up her equal and her mate. In vain she stooped to equal them with her heights. Too pure that air was for small souls to breathe.